This is James Keeling of Synaptic Jam Productions, available at www.jameskeeling.com, and you're listening to episode 19 of Compensating Controls. Synaptic Jam Productions presents Compensating Controls, the debut podcast novel from author James Keeling. Warning: parental guidance suggested for some language and mild to extreme scenes of violence. Welcome to episode number 19. If you noticed, the bumper for this episode was read by me, James Keeling. And yes, there is a reason for this. Stay tuned at the end of the episode for an important message. Now, where were we? After the big to-do at the Mall of America, Nick has come up with yet another plan. Both Mattal and Agent Hoffman are still a couple of steps behind. Let's see what happens next. Chapter 40. Agent Peter Hoffman sat at the table in the Fort Snelling Central Operations Room, surrounded by the different team members working on this operation. To his right was Officer Hernandez, and on his left was Agent Brent Dunn, with Howard Taylor to his left. They all had their hands in their laps and were trying their best to stay out of the direct line of fire. Deputy Director Sands was on the large screen, and his amplified voice was being piped in through the speakers strategically placed around the room.
How is it, Agent, that this terrorist ass clown, Nicholas Edgewood, is not behind bars yet? How many people have been killed so far during this investigation?
4, sir. Actually, we believe the deaths have...
The director's loud voice overrode him and stunned him into silence.
4! 4 corpses! And from what I've seen, 2 of them have been gruesome beyond description. I believe that qualifies as a trail of bodies, don't you? And trails lead somewhere, so follow the damn trail and get this guy. How many men are gonna die, Agent? How many more have to die before you do your job?
Sir, I respectfully object to the intimation that...
Object all you want, Agent. But I want him found, and I want him found now. That data must be retrieved. The longer it remains out there, the higher the likelihood we will never get it back.
Howard let out a low whistle and was surreptitiously trying to get Peter's attention from the other side of Agent Dunn. He scribbled a note on his pad and, without looking, slid it over to where Peter sat. Peter glanced down at the paper, quickly reading its contents. Email from Nick. Says it all ends tonight. More to come. Peter turned his attention back to the teleconference.
Yes, sir. We're on it, and we will retrieve the data as soon as possible. You can rely on us. Will there be anything else?
Sands harumphed and sputtered a bit, finally saying,
Clear the room, Agent.
Peter asked everyone else to leave the room and responded to Sands' unspoken question with a single word. Secure.
About the Mall of America incident,
the deputy director began.
I know that the suspect was directly involved. This is an unacceptable amount of exposure, Agent Hoffman. As I mentioned earlier, this operation is to be kept as discreet as possible, and the fiasco at the largest mall in the United States garnered way too much attention.
Any news on the man who fell to his death, sir?
Hutchins, Colonel, U.S. Special Forces, retired. He was an asset. He led a highly trained team that we have used on occasion. I do not know who he was working for in this case, but his team is off limits as it pertains to your investigation. Is that understood?
But sir, one of them gunned down a security guard in a Bloomingdale's department store.
I realize that, Agent Hoffman. Nevertheless, they are off limits. We have already initiated contact, and they are being diverted. Is that understood?
The tone had turned brusque and businesslike again, brooking no argument.
Yes, sir. Did you get my message about the possible involvement of the controller?
Yes, I did. Until you have definitive proof, go with the assumption it isn't the man you're thinking of. Now you get back out there and retrieve that data. Let me know when you have something to report.
Thank you, sir. I'll get back to you as soon as I can. I've got a couple of leads I'm tracking down with Mr. Edgewood's associated email contacts. I hope to have much more information later on tonight.
The screen went dark as the deputy director signed off the teleconference. Peter turned to Howard's chair, only to realize the room was still empty. He called the others back in, and they retook their seats around the conference table. He held up the handwritten note.
Did this just come in?
Yes, sir, Howard replied. It just popped up in Nick's Gmail account. I could try to track the email down to its source, but so far Nick has been really careful about where he transmits from, and well, most likely it would result in a dead end.
As time permits, go ahead and track it down as best you can. He may show us a pattern by which we can track him down.
Julio Hernandez leaned forward and addressed the rest of the table.
You think he'll have Miss Cox with him?
I bet on it, Officer Hernandez.
They're connected in this somehow. No matter how Miss Cox Reynolds became involved, it seems like they're in this together now. Also, I want to track down that bastard killer, too. He may be the key to everything.
Agent Dunn glanced back and forth between the three other men at the table.
You don't believe Nicholas Edgewood killed those guys, do you?
Haven't you read the reports? Peter asked. There's a third party, a sadistic bastard by all accounts. He's the one responsible for the deaths of both Mr. Wallace and Mr. Sigler. We were first tipped off to him by the scene in the alley where we found the knife we believe was used in the murder of Mr. Wallace. Of course, we have possession of that knife, which would seem to indicate that either he used something else to kill Mr. Sigler, or that it might even be a different person who killed the two men. Given the nature of the murders, it does seem clear they were both killed by the same person. I'm still thinking it was this killer who had been after both Miss Edgewood and Miss Cox from virtually the beginning. Given his communications with us, it would appear that Mr. Nicholas Edgewood is in fact innocent of both the murders and the theft of the data.
Brent leaned back in his chair, crossing his arms over his ample stomach.
But if you follow that reasoning, that Mr. Edgewood, or Nick, if you prefer, is innocent of the data theft, then that throws into question where the data is at all. If he hasn't got it, where is it? From the report on Mr. Wallace, it appears you believe he stole the data. But if he did, where is it now? Assuming he was killed for it, wouldn't the killer have the data? Who is to say the data hasn't been copied across the internet to 100 different servers by now? Howard, am I wrong in thinking this?
No, you're not wrong. If it were me, the first thing I would have done is either copied or just save it onto a server someplace on the internet. It is private data, however, so I don't think I would have spread it too widely. I probably would have picked one or two servers to save it to.
So, continued Brent, assuming that this killer is the one both at Wallace's apartment and at the Sigler house, wouldn't you assume that this guy had the data? Or at least the location?
True, admitted Peter.
But then, why worry so much about Edgewood and Cox?
At this time, they're our best lead on how to find this murderer and the missing data.
Assuming that neither Edgewood nor Cox is actually the murderer,
Brent reasoned.
True again, but I'm pretty sure they aren't. Howard, show them the transcript from our little chat session.
Peter had asked Howard to temporarily omit the chat session transcript from the case file, at least for the time being. Howard reached into a folder he had placed on the desk. Wordlessly, Howard handed the transcript over to Brent. After reading the transcript, Brent looked at Peter, staring intently at him until finally he relaxed.
I see where you're coming from, Peter.
I'm with you. I've spent too much time around the bad guys. It looks like this might have been a good guy put in a very bad place. Personally, I don't like that. I saw the note as it passed under me, and if tonight's going to be the night, we'd better be ready. Will he contact you the same way?
I believe so.
All right. I've been stationed here for quite a while, and between Officer Hernandez and me, we should be able to put together a pretty good team for you. Julio, let's get to work.
Peter was surprised at what he perceived as the change in Brent Dunn. What he had originally taken for a donut repository had become a caring and reasoned professional. He mentally berated himself for jumping to conclusions and knocked down his first impression sixth sense a couple of notches. The room became a bustling whirlwind of activity as calls were made, transportation arranged for, and provisions made for God knows what might happen later on that night. One thing Peter knew, no matter what was coming, they would be ready, with bells on.
Chapter 41. Connectron, a local ISP serving the Twin Cities area of Minnesota, was housed in a warehouse-style building in the southern suburb of Burnsville. Sitting just off the intersection of Highway 77 and Highway 13, the building was situated in an industrial park
about 3 miles away from the nearest residential area. Outwardly, the building resembled the 20 other buildings in the office park, but had one major exception. The entire center of the building had been converted into a huge data center about 2 football fields in size. Not only did Connectron house its own hosted solutions there, they also leased out space to a number of other companies in the area, providing both the environmental systems as well as internet bandwidth necessary to conduct business in the information age. Nick had been here many times. Not only did Allied Computing house its internet presence in the data center, this was where Scott Sigler worked, or at least had worked. Nick had done a bit of consulting, coming in and helping Scott fix problems for the ISP's client base. No matter how great computers became, no matter how fast or fault-tolerant they were, whenever people were involved, things were bound to break, and it was people like Nick and Scott who kept it all running. Take any modern company and remove their ability to use email for a day, and see just how productive they are. Nick always carried his access cards on him, and he had a few of them. Separate cards for the office front door, data center outer door, and data center inner door. It was no big deal for him to gain access to the data center, and he and Cassandra entered the large building and made their way towards the double doors that marked the boundary between the building proper and the environmentally controlled data center. As they navigated their way through yet another cubicle farm, Nick grabbed a large Sharpie marker from a desk. When he reached the large double doors to the data center, he used his card to open them. They both felt a small wall of air rush outwards. Nick saw Cassandra's confused expression and explained that a positive pressure was maintained in the room so that when the door was opened, dust would blow out and not be inadvertently sucked in. Nick then blocked the doors open with a Sharpie marker, and together they entered the operations floor. The area was huge, and Cassandra was sure it could not actually fit inside the building she had seen from the outside. From where they had entered, the walls extended at least 150 feet in either direction, and she could just barely make out the opposite wall about 200 feet away. The roof extended about 15 feet above them, with fluorescent lighting hung from the ceiling, making the room seem as bright as day. As she walked in, she was disconcerted to notice that she appeared to be standing on a rather large sheet of flypaper. Her shoes scritched on the flypaper, and she looked inquisitively at Nick. "It's meant to get the dust off your shoes, that's all. And yes, it is cold in here. Constant temperature and humidity. It's done on purpose, and no, I can't turn up the thermostat. Sorry." They walked further into the data center, and she was led around a number of large cabinets, which Nick referred to as racks, containing more computers, which Nick referred to as servers. Cassandra had never seen so much computer equipment in one place in her whole life. There were blinking lights everywhere. She followed in flabbergasted silence as Nick led her across the floor. "Okay," Nick said. "What?" Cassandra had trouble hearing him above the din of noise created by the machines and environmental systems all around them. "Okay," Nick raised his voice to be heard. "In the grand scheme of things, this is where we roll up our sleeves and we get to work." He pulled the large blue duffel bag from his right shoulder and placed it on the floor. He knelt down and unzipped it. Okay, so we're getting ready to wrap it up within the next couple of episodes. Now to answer the question as to why I read the bumper for my own podcast. I've waited until this point to do this for multiple reasons. Reason number one, I wanted to ensure you, the listener, that you're going to get a good, complete product. Basically, I wanted to let you know that this story wouldn't podfade, and that you'll get the whole thing because you deserve it. Hopefully, I produced the content reliably enough that you know you can trust me to produce. Reason number two, if you're listening to this, which of course you are, the story must have been engaging enough to hold your attention and hopefully entertain you in the process. It was a lot of fun to write, and I'm very glad that I've had the chance to share it with you. Reason number three. This is the crux of the matter. There are many reasons to podcast your novel. One is to share it with the world. And the other is to hopefully make a little something-something on the backside. And this is where we find ourselves now. I realize things are really tough out there for a lot of us, some worse than others. I'd really appreciate it if you could kick a bit back my way. As things are currently set up, I've got a couple of routes that you can follow. Route number one,
purchase a copy of the ebook. Compensating Controls is available on the Kindle and available through the Kindle store. Just go out to Amazon and search for my name and Compensating Controls and you'll find it. I've listed it for $3.99, and I'd really appreciate it if you'd pick up a copy. I'll also place a link in the show notes. If you just want a copy of the EPUB version of the novel, feel free to PayPal a donation and I'll send a copy of it along. Way number two. I've got a PayPal donate button on my webpage at www.jameskeeling, link in the show notes. Feel free to send some electronic love my way. As an alternative, I could burn a CD or a DVD for you of the audio. Of course, this is already provided within the feed. If this is something you think I should do, let me know. If there's any other way you would like to see me offer this content, for remunerative purposes, of course, please let me know. Rest assured, I've got my eye on Smashwords and the other really well-known distribution channels. If the need is there, I'd be happy to fill the hole. Compensating Controls has been my first podcast novel. And as such, it's taught me many things. Believe me, I've learned a lot. And everything I've learned, I plan on applying to my next podcast novel. The next novel from James Keeling and Synepticon Productions will be Subversion, Sacrifice, and Salvation. It's currently undergoing production. For the podcast version, I'm thinking about stepping it up a bit in the production area. You deserve the best product that I can offer, and I want to give it to you. Well, that's about it. I've got a lot to do, both writerly and non-writerly, so I better get back to it. The needful must be done. So, time to put on my big boy... my big boy voice. So once again, this is James Keeling of Synepticon Productions, wishing you clear skies and a crimson sunset.
You have been listening to Compensating Controls, the breakout novel by podcast author James Keeling. For more information and more content, please visit the website at www.jameskeeling.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Synaptic Jam, or like me on Facebook, also at Synaptic Jam. Music and sounds generously provided by Incompetech.com and Freesound.org. Compensating Controls is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 3.0 Unported license, so please share it with everyone and spread the word. Just don't change it or make money off it. Or if you do, please send that money to me. Swiss bank account available upon request.
Pop filter in place. Drink water, because I can. How is it that... Sorry, if I can get this right. How is it, Agent, that this terrorist ass clown, Nicholas Edgewood, is not behind bars yet? How many people have you been killed? How many people have you been killed? In a Bloomingdale's department. There we go. Peter turned to Howard's chair, only to realize the groom was still empty. Oh my god, the groom is on fire. Thank you. Jeez, see, I can do better than that. Brent leaned back in his chair, crossing his arms over his ample stomach.
Page change.
True, true, true,
true,
true, admitted Peter.
Now I'm recording. Ha, pop filter in place.
Well, that was an interesting paragraph. She followed in a flabbergasted silence,